This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
In addition to that, so let's begin. In addition to that, we're going to now continue with the next subject that we had been introduced very briefly. So we talked about the first verse. Sorry, let me grab this. So this is where we're at. We have finished introducing the surah. We talked a little bit about where it was revealed and how just a couple of verses here and there, scholars had differed. But the point is, at the end of the day, this was still considered to be a Madani surah. That's important. Because when the moment you hear a surah is revealed in the Madani stage, that immediately tells you that that surah is going to be filled and packed with ahkam and rulings of our deen. So another reason why the surah is called Surah An-Nisa is that it also addresses all of the rulings that pertain to women and some of the issues that they faced with. So a lot of those ahkam and rulings of do's and don'ts and things like that are all mentioned and introduced in this particular surah. So we said this many times. This is a unique subject or chapter of the Qur'an. It is extremely unique. There is no chapter in the Qur'an that compares to Surah An-Nisa. And that's, again, important. When you look at all these 114 chapters, they synchronize with other subjects. They share with other subjects. One surah will start a particular subject. Other surahs will fill in the blanks. But not Surah An-Nisa. Everything that it starts with, it ends in the surah itself. And so some of the ulama, some of the scholars of tafsir said that even if Surah An-Nisa was excluded out of the Qur'an, it would be a Qur'an by itself. Right? Because of how complete and unique the surah is. So we introduced this particular verse, which we've already gone through, talking about pretty much the foundation and the principles that are needed to create a strong and healthy community. It started off this way because from a healthy community, now you start assessing the families that build that community. So that's what the rest of the verses will now go into. We talked about and introduced the subject of orphans. We talked about that in this particular ayah, Allah did something very unique for young people. What did He do? He immediately called out that their properties and money belong to them. So don't try to take, don't try to steal, don't try to be stingy with their wealth. It belongs to them. So make sure you preserve and protect and honor the rights of these orphans. Which again, in comparison to how the Quran addresses this and how people treat orphans in this day and age, again, we're not talking, you know, in every culture and society. We're just talking generally across the board. You know, it's very common to find orphanages where these kids do go through some sense of struggle. They're not given certain amount of rights. They're not given privileges like this. Their wealth probably, it's been handled by a particular system or organization, so they're restricted to how much access they may have to their own money and wealth. So it still does become a very difficult journey for them being under this umbrella of an orphan. So this surah introduces them, but protects them as well. It's going to also talk about, so as you see at the end of this particular verse, indeed that is ever a great sin. So Allah gives us a warning here. It's a great sin if you take advantage of orphans and their wealth. That's the warning. It's going to go a step further than that. Why? Because the audience of this surah didn't get this ayah. They heard it, but they didn't internalize it and understand it and practice it. They still took advantage. Kind of sounds like what a lot of Muslims do today with many aspects of our deen. They know the reminder. They understand what the Quran is saying, but it doesn't actually reflect how they practice their life or some of the things and choices they make in their life. So keep that in mind, that just because in context it might be referring to one particular group, we, you and I, can still get a lesson out of this. And that's one of the beauty and miracles of the Qur'an. We talked a little bit about these scenarios of when the wealth can be used. And again, I put this here especially for us in this part of the world that probably have never been exposed to this group and subjects like this, to kind of just tickle your appetite of how this subject is discussed in our deen. And that led us to this particular subject. وَإِنْ خِفْتُمْ أَلَّا تُقِسِطُوا فِي الْيَتَامَ. And if you fear that you will not deal justly with them. Okay, so this was the ayah of polygamy, but it also started off and continued with the same subject. And from this, we looked at a brief overview of shared rights and responsibilities between the husband and wife. So that was a list of just some of the general ones. There are a few more, but these are the most important of them. And that brought us here. So this is our next verse moving forward. Okay. So, verse number 4 is where we are at. Now we're going to be introduced to another crucial subject of Surah An-Nisa, which of course is the mahar. Have you heard of this before? The mahar. Even if you're not married, you've heard of the mahar. And the mahar is a massive, massive subject in our deen. Not just in Islam, not just religiously speaking, in the world today. Many cultures and religions have different names for this. If you call this a dowry, technically that is not what the mahar is in Islam. Because in some cultures the dowry is optional. Whereas the mahar, immediately it's compulsory, it's wajib. The marriage is not valid without it. Now here's the first point that I want you to note. We were just talking about orphans and their rights, weren't we? Right? How did we get here? وَآتُ النِّسَاءَ صَدَقَاتِهِنَّ نِحْلًا. And give the women upon marriage their bridal gifts graciously. How did we jump from that subject to this? Is there a relationship or a connection between the previous ayah and this? Yeah. Absolutely. Can anybody share what you think that connection is? Go ahead. Let's.
It was talking about the orphan girls. If you can deal with them justly, then you can marry them. So now it's the conditions coming up that if you have to marry them and deal with them.
Good, good. So here's what's happening, right? Eventually, these orphans are going to mature. They're going to grow. And they're going to have certain needs and responsibilities as well. And many of them will desire marriage for themselves one day. That's perfectly normal, isn't it? So as they continue to mature, they're going to also have the desire to start their own family and not have to live under someone's care anymore. So this ayah is introducing the subject because any of the ones who are the protectors or the carers of these orphans, that eventually if these orphans stay with them for that period of time, and as they get older and either, you know, one of their own kids desire to marry these orphan, this particular orphan or what, or somebody else, at least that opportunity is open for them. So Allah begins bringing in the discussion of the mahar itself. Here's the thing. Now you really have to understand the pattern that's happening here. Because the mahar is not the most important thing when you're thinking about marrying someone, is it? This is all about money. This is a gift. You know, that's not the first thing that comes to mind when someone desires marriage. There's usually many things that happen. The connection. In the Quran, that's called sakina, right? So there's this connection, and there's this bit of tranquility that this person feels right. None of that is even talked about here. Do you know why? Because those things, when it comes to feelings and emotions, they will manifest themselves, right? They have a particular way of, depending on the person, how those feelings develop and how they become stronger and how they eventually lead to this kind of conversation, marriage. Because let's face it, this is how you tell the difference between people who will talk to somebody just to get to know them and somebody who's talking to someone and they have the intention of marriage. It's two completely different types of conversations with two different intentions. Now this here, When we're talking about the mahar, look at the bottom. Maybe for those of you at the back, you probably won't see it very well. The mahar is a type of living security for her. It shows that you are willing to go above and beyond to serve and protect her. So, really what's being talked about here is not just fulfilling this particular duty, you know, fulfill this honor, fulfill this right, pay the mahar, okay, I'm good. I've given it graciously. Whew, that's done. Now I have to deal with this, this, and this. No, it's an attitude here. There's something deeper, and that is, are you willing to make the ultimate priority to want and marry this person for the sake of protecting, providing, and whether you like it or not, whether you go through tough times or not, you are still willing, with the right intention, to put every ounce and effort in making sure that she lives a normal and safe and secure life. That's what the mahar is. Unfortunately, very few marriages, very few people talk about it that way. Usually, now I want you to walk through with me on this, okay? All the sisters that are here, none of you are married. All the brothers that are here, none of you are married. So I want you to just imagine, right, that you found someone. And this brother asks you and talks, and you guys talk about this mahar thing. She says to you, I want a computer. Okay? She just says, I just want a computer. He can't go on like Kijiji now and just start looking for a used computer. And he's like, that's perfect because you can get computers for like $20. Actually, if I go to IIT, they might give me one for free. Because they have computers lying around all over the place, so I could just grab one. Don't get to do that. Why? Because there's a key word in this ayah. But before we get to that key word, the attitude that you have to fulfill this mahar is the first thing that is captured in this verse. What does Allah say? وَآتُ النِّسَى. He doesn't say, okay, think about it, prepare yourself, discuss, and then see if it works. He said to the men, give it to them. Case closed. So we don't have no right to negotiate this anymore. We can't compromise. Okay, I'll give you this. This is what I need in return. You know, I'll give you the mahar. I need you to buy a fridge for us or something, you know. You can't do that. Allah says, just give it to them. Secondly, the word that is used to describe the mahar in this verse is called sadaqat. Sadaqat literally comes from the word sidqun, which means the truth. So the connection is this. What kind of truth does the mahar manifest in a marriage? So if the mahar is a kind of truth that, you know, that reflects a marriage, in what sense? How does it do that? Yeah. Yeah. Good. Okay. So that's a good start. Okay. So it shows that you are willing to commit, to try your very best, to give her some kind of equal or similar to lifestyle from where she came from, and the mahar would reflect that. So for example, if she comes from a real poor home, but she asks you, look, I want a bag of gold. You know, and it's got to be gold from Italy. And it's got to weigh this amount of pounds. And it's got to be this texture and blah, 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 blah. It kind of gives you an idea of what she would hope that you could fulfill in terms of, okay, these are some of my expectations that I want to feel secure. I want to be able to have this. And this is, by the way, completely halal. Don't frown at this or don't look down. If somebody does ask for an expensive mahar, $100,000, no one has the right to say that mahar is haram. You understand this. You know, and one of our professors used to tell us, if that happens to you and you complain, oh my God, she wants so much from me. She's trying to just drain my life out and before we even get married. That is an indication for you that perhaps that this is not the kind of person that you are able to fulfill and maintain that level of lifestyle. Like, it's just not for you. So you have to respect that. You can't just say to her, look, I know you want 100 grand, but, you know, how are we going to fit all of that in this trailer that we're going to live in? You know? Or we're going to be living with my aunt and my uncles and their 34 cousins. We're all going to be in the same home. It's just not going to work. Can't do that. This is how immediately this relationship is going to indicate whether the compatibility works here or not. And Allah starts off that journey through, can you fulfill an appropriate mahar, a mahar that she's pleased with? So go back to that whole computer example. She asks for a computer. The responsibility is you go back to her. What kind of computer do you want? She says, you know what? Forget the computer, I want an iPad and I want it to be an Android or something, like a tablet. So I want a Samsung tablet. And as a matter of fact, she saw the commercial, so she wants that exact same one. It's the brand new, latest, most compact. That's the one she wants. He can afford it. There's no reason why he can't. Case closed. Where does this come from? The word here is called nihla. See that third check mark? Nihla. Nihla is not just a romantic gift. It's the kind of gift that when she gets it, she's like, oh my God, you got this for me? You actually got the thing that I asked for? That's what nihla is. If that reaction is not given to you when the mahar is presented, take a hint, right? It's the wrong mahar, or it's not what she wanted. Some brothers say, no, you know what? The Prophet, والسلام, you know, he told some companions that even if they didn't have a mahar, they could just teach Qur'an. So I'm just going to ask you, look, I'll teach you Qur'an. That's even more valuable. We're not even allowed to make that suggestion. This is 100% her control and right. This is her steering wheel, and she decides where she wants to drive it. Second point, so the order came. Allah called the mahr here sadaqat. This is the first indication before a marriage happens where you can show your level of commitment and sincerity to the relationship. Third thing is Allah called this gift nihla. And nihla, we said, is that she's overjoyed in happiness and contentment that you got her something. However, there is some commentary on the other side. That generally speaking, she should also, when she decides on a mahar, consider his situation. You know, if the poor guy is working overtime at Walmart, don't ask him for like $500,000, right? So consider those things, and then you make a decision from that point forward. She is also allowed to request a service from him. So she doesn't want a gift. She can say to him, I want you to cook for 1 year. I don't ever want to see my kitchen. Yeah. I want you to, you know, shovel the driveway or something, like some random thing. He can do that.
Okay, some people... I don't agree with that, because that's not her duty anyway. Like, that's what the culture puts on her, but there's no way in the Quran or Sunnah where you can say that she has to cook for him or clean for him. Or...
No. She can stipulate that. She can say to him, you know what? I don't need you to buy me anything. I want you to do this for me. I want you to serve me in a different way. Fulfill this chore or task. And this came from a hadith of our Prophet ﷺ when he asked that sahaba about how much Qur'an he had memorized. And then he said to her, okay, the Qur'an that you've memorized, that is going to be your mahar. They extracted from this that, and this is under all the madahib, that you can actually offer this as a mahar as well, some kind of service. If you want to go for hajj, that's a pretty popular mahar these days. I personally find that very difficult for an average couple these days. Just why? Because, you know, to be able to fulfill that, circumstances change so quickly every year, there's just no guarantee. Because you have to also stipulate a timeline for that as well. Take me for hajj by any year before 2020. And if it didn't happen and he still can't do it, then you run into some issues again. So there has to be a beginning and end to this. This all falls under nihla. Now, if you continue now with this ayah, But if they give you up willingly, who is they? If the wife. Here's what's happened now. This word that's mentioned here is called طِبِن. فَإِن طِبِنَ لَكُمْ. طِبِن is what you see here, the fourth check mark. This is where, imagine you go out for dinner, right? And he takes you to like a real nice restaurant. And when the bill comes up, he does this. He looks at the bill and he's like, oh my God. إِنَّا لِلَّهِ وَإِنَّا إِلَيْهِ رَاجِعُونَ, right? And do you mind if I just make sajda before we look at, you know? He like, and then he says, and then she looks at him and she's like, oh my God, is it that bad? He's like, don't worry, these are tears of joy. I'm just, you know, don't worry about it. That's called طِبِن. It's when you're putting on this guilt, you know, whatever it is, this show for a moment, to kind of develop for her to feel really sorry and unhappy and be like, you know what? It was your mahar to bring me to the most expensive restaurant, and you know what? It's okay. Just, I'll help you with this here. And then she gives him some money. That's called طِبِن. That is not allowed. And this ayah is saying here, she has to do that voluntarily. So out of her own mercy, she's like, oh, you miskeen child. Okay, you can't handle the bill? You can't handle the bill. Okay, you know what? الآن خفف الله عنكم وعلم أن فيكم ضعفا, right? She quotes in the ayah that, okay, Allah has now recognized the weak and you are the weak, so I'm going to help you now, you know? So she's out of her own goodwill, she decides, you know, I'll cover half the bill too. He's not allowed to do this. And this here is really, really common. It's more common than you want to think and even imagine. This is how specific this one ayah has introduced this concept, the subject of the mahar. So you're not allowed to put her through any kind of guilt trip so that she could feel sorry for you and reduce the mahar. That's the point. But طِبِن is, she has to voluntarily, out of her own, recognize, okay, he's really struggling here, let me help him out. Then it continues. And the way the ayah concludes is, so if they give up willingly to you anything of it, فَكُلُوهُ هَنِيًا مَرِيئًا, then take it in satisfaction and ease. Hani, something that goes down easily. Mani, the canal between the throat and stomach. In other words, if she says to you, how much is the bill? And you look at it, it's like $300. She says, okay, fine. Here's $10. What does Allah say? Take it, accept it, let it go down easily. Don't ask anything about it. Alhamdulillah, thank you. Don't be like, you know, I was looking at your bank account this morning and, you know, our bank accounts are linked, so $10, that's it. It's okay. You don't get to do that. See how strict this is? You know, the way that I'm talking about this, I've taught marriage in other places before, and when I get to this subject and introduce it this way, I kid you not, half the students have no idea what I'm saying. They can't imagine that's how the mahar works. You mean he really doesn't have to cage me and put me and corner me and force this on me? You mean I can actually stipulate a date when this is over, even though I've been married 35 years with him and he still hasn't paid me my mahar? That's this ayah. This is just the introduction. So, putting this now in context, this actually happened several times with the Messenger, alayhi salatu wasalam. Companions after companions came to him. And as a matter of fact, when we say companions, we're talking about the wives. Ya Rasulullah, he promised me this. Didn't give it. Ya Rasulullah, he said he would do this, he would buy me this, he would get me this piece of land. He never did. Instead, I got nothing from him. Immediately, there are several narrations throughout the Sunnah. Imam Ahmad in his Musnad has a whole section of these different ahadith. And just explaining that generally when these women came, the Prophet's response to all of them was always one thing. Let's go and settle this. If you guys are going to have to separate, we'll separate the two of you. Like there was this no-nonsense approach from him, alayhi salatu wasalam. So I hope that when you look at this subject and you look at this verse, you immediately get some perspective of what the mahar really is and what it truly represents. It is not a transaction. This is what you want. Okay, let me get it for you. Wassalamu alaikum. We never have to talk about that again. The attitude, you know, the wisdom of this mahar carries on for the rest of the marriage. Now, there are some side points here, right? There are some side issues. So just to summarize a couple of the points that we looked at, right? So it's a mandatory gift from a husband to his wife. So what if you've never agreed with for a mahar? Lots of marriages are the same. They married ages ago and no mahar was agreed upon. So what do you do then? The Prophet ﷺ again was approached by sahabas who had this dilemma. And when this was legislated, they were already married. So the Prophet ﷺ ordered, of course, you know, to renew their intention, renew their nikah, etc. But when it came to the mahar, if it wasn't agreed upon because pretty much no one really realized how important it was, that's one thing. Then you can agree on a mahar anytime throughout the marriage. But if it was just carelessly left out, okay, if she doesn't talk about it, then I'm not going to talk about it either. And if nobody mentions it, case closed. That's a big problem. That's where the couple now will have to stand in front of an imam or go to somebody who can judge the situation and come to a conclusion that whether, okay, you know what, you guys need to make a mahar right now, which most cases that will happen, and then he will be a witness over to ensure that the mahar is fulfilled. So you have to keep him now as the so-called judge to ensure that this was fulfilled. What if you get a mahar and that's not the mahar you asked for? Then what do you do then? So you asked for, you know, you asked for some money. You said, you know, you wanted $5,000. The only problem is he gave you $5,000 in like West Indian money that's worth like 5 cents here. He's like, you didn't specify the currency. So here you go. I've heard it all. You know, as silly as this sounds, wallahi, I kid you not. These same couples, especially, unfortunately, the wives, come to our offices in tears because of what's happened with them. You know, they didn't know, or they were misinformed, or they were told this is the way it's going to happen, or they married back home somewhere. So no one, they had their own culture back there. And so when they learned about all of this, they were really stuck. So what happens in this case? Same thing. If you didn't get what you asked for and it wasn't specified, well, you know, certain things need to also be done and specified, and then the whole agreement is renewed in front of the imam again. Point is, do you see there's no way out of this? I've never heard of a fatwa where, oh, that didn't happen, okay, don't worry, there's no mahar anymore. It almost never happens. It can be tangible wealth or a service commitment. The mahar must be paid as soon as possible or based on a mutual agreement. This is a huge mistake that people make, that couples make with their mahar. So if he says, you know, I'll take you to Hajj or I'll take you to the vacation, I'll take you somewhere, and that date is not stipulated. That's a really important detail and it has to be there. So the mahar has to have a beginning and end to it. Although permissible, stipulating an expensive or hard to achieve mahar is disliked in our deen. Why do I say that? Our Prophet ﷺ says, as you see in front of you, the marriage with the easiest mahar has the most blessings. Again, it's out of her own discretion. She should not ever be compelled to do any of this. So at the end of the day, if she still chooses a high mahar, you fulfill it. The politics behind it and culture is something they have to work out on their own, right? If no mahar was agreed upon pre-marriage, depending on the reason, it can be agreed upon at any time. So again, depending on what that reason is, then you go from there. And the most important thing is that the mahar is agreed upon in front of a judge or an imam. Okay, let's move on. Young people and money, verse number 5. That was the introduction of that one theme. Don't lose it, because why? It's going to be brought up again later on in this surah. Yeah.
Wait, is dhibn allowed? Or just to clarify, so it is allowed? Dhibn is allowed?
It is allowed, and it's voluntarily out of her own. She shouldn't be compelled or, you know, hinted to or guilt-tripped, none of those things. Has to come solely and freely from the goodness of her heart. And, you know, our deen encourages that as well. You see your husband struggling, you know, just... You try your best because it is your husband. This is not a friend. This is somebody that's part of your life. So you do try out of the goodness of your heart to see how you make that easy. And the same thing with the husband as well, right? You live your life with that person in order to, you both work together to see whatever struggles you have, that you try to support one another through those struggles. Yes, go ahead.
So in a case where it's not something mutually decided,
mm-hmm.
Let's say, you know, 20 years ago it wasn't well known or whatever, your culture, your parents just said it, you don't even know. You are to mutually decide it after?
So but it depends. Like,
no,
so
idea, like,
if the mahar was never mutually decided,
right,
but one was paid, so he says to you, you know, we never really agreed, but actually when I bought you this or we did this or I gave you this, that was actually like my dowry or my gift to you. So let's just count that as that. The way you get out of that is it has to be done officially. And it should be done in front of an imam, where you say to an imam, okay, listen, we never really talked about a mahar, but he did do this for me or gave me this. And I would like this to be counted as the mahar. Or you can say in front of him, he did do all of that, but that's actually not what I want as a mahar.
So if a couple is not really informed,
mm-hmm.
is it the imam's responsibility to
yeah.
make sure? Okay, so nobody does that yet.
No.
Like in the past at least.
Yeah, yeah. It's tough.
I'm going to admit, like my parents just put an amount and
yeah.
I have no idea.
Like, yeah. And
I would have to research what it was, the amount, and then discuss it. Like I've been married 20 years.
Yeah, yeah, so yeah.
It's like they don't do that. And even recent marriages, it's when you don't know, you don't even know the guy. Sometimes
yeah.
it's not chosen, like it's semi-arranged or whatever, like, you know, the circumstances, you're not that comfortable and you don't discuss these things.
Yeah, yeah.
The imams really should, before they do the nikah, have a meeting with the husband.
They should. You know, it's unfortunate. I think we can all agree.
Like, I'm going to go home and ask my dad what my hair was. I have no idea. I have no idea. I'm telling you.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I mean...
I'm going to be going to have my husband.
Thank God I'm going for Umrah, so no one will find me.
I mean, alhamdulillah, he's done a million things, you know, like, Ibn is like...
Yeah.
But it's a technicality, and it has to do with the validity of your marriage, so...
So remember, right, guys, at the end of the day, right, this is why, you know, these situations do not have a concrete response and answer to them. It varies for almost every marriage and relationship out there. That's why it needs to be sat in front of, I mean, we don't have judges, right? So it needs to be sat in front of a qualified imam. And there are several ways to get out of this. And one of those options as well is, let's just all agree that what has been done, that is the mahar, and he'll write something if he needs to, and says, okay, case closed, right? Because you definitely don't want, after several years of the marriage, and especially when more or less that marriage has been a good, happy marriage, that you don't want to disrupt or upset all of that because of this one thing. But you do, however, if you need clarity, you know, you have to have trust in him. Yeah, you can certainly do that in front of, you know, an imam. And I mean, several imams do that to an extent. So, I by the way, no one come to me because I don't do that, right? I was once upon a time a marriage counselor, but very limited now, right? So, my point is this. At the end of the day, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in this particular verse seeks to preserve and protect something that was taken from women for several years prior to this surah. Which is when it came to wealth and money, they had none of that. Now the rules changed so quickly that not only does she does get inheritance, now she gets a mandatory gift that she gets to choose what it should be. Can you imagine how the Quraysh and the Muslims or the Mushrikeen felt when they heard this? All those tribal leaders were like, oh my God, what? We have to now give them stuff? This was huge in the Muslim culture at that time. So what you see in front of you, this was a revolution by itself. But now we're mandated that we have to give them something. So that's the introduction. It goes deeper and deeper. This surah will literally take that community with all these problems and literally flip it upside down. So this is just the beginning. Then we now hit another subject. So when we're done now, okay, with women and their rights, and specifically when it came to this issue of the mahar, okay, Allah now adds to this. وَلَا تُؤْتُ السُّفَهَاءَ أَمْوَالَكُمْ Allah says, and don't give fools your money. Sufaha, safihun, literally is somebody that does something and they don't think it through. They're carelessly jumping into a responsibility or an action without thinking things through. That's literally what safih is. Safih is also somebody that just blurts out whatever it is that they feel or think. So whether it hurts you or insults you or offends you, they don't care. Imam Shafi'i rahimahullah said, I never respond to the safih of people. Because he had a problem. Every time he would give a talk, especially when he was in his circle with thousands of his students, there'd always be this one person here and there that would get up and start shouting at him and arguing with him. Right? It happens occasionally even now. You'll have this one person that just puts on their Superman cape and just comes at the teacher. They might disagree or what have you. Imam Shafi'i rahimahullah, his approach to this was he would just remain quiet. Look at the man. Okay. You done? Yeah. Okay. When the man finished and he calms down, he's like, okay, sit down. And he continues as if the man wasn't even there to begin with. Some of his students asked him, why do you do that? He says, I never respond to them because I leave them so that they can live in their stupidity. Just leave them. Because if I talk to them, that just feeds it even further. So I leave it until they realize that they can't get what they want out of me. And then he can deal with it in a more civilized manner. There was even more like contemporary examples like this. The great scholar, Sheikh bin Baz, rahimahullah, when he was in the Prophet's mosque in the early 80s, he was teaching, and the same thing. There was this one man that came from South Africa, and he had moved to Medina, and he sat in the Sheikh's circle, and he would constantly stand up and shout at him, stand up and shout at him. But only on top of that, he would also insult the Sheikh in front of the thousands of students, saying, you're this and you're that, you don't know what you're talking about, you think you're blah, 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 blah. You know, the Sheikh was blind. So when he's speaking, he's just as us, his heart is talking to everyone. Point is that years go by and his students are always asking him, ya Sheikh, why don't you stop this? We try to stop him and you stop us from stopping him. So the Sheikh says, just leave him, leave him. Every now and then he would talk to the person and tell him, okay, just relax, yes, this is what I meant, blah, 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 blah. Eventually, later on, what happened is that same South African man, he passed away. And Sheikh bin Baz, rahimahullah, heard that same person now has passed away. You know what he did? He passed away back home in South Africa or somewhere nearby. The Sheikh booked a flight, flew to his janazah, and led the janazah over the man. And when he asked, his students asked him, why? And he said, you know, when somebody is in this state, when they pass away, it's case closed. Now their affairs is with Allah. The least I can do for my brother is pray for him. Like, those kinds of hearts are hard to find. Right? Where people can disagree and still get along. It's almost unheard of in our ummah. Just think about, so when you look at all of that, in context here now, and don't give fools your money. It's not a very nice word, but it is capturing something about young people. Generally speaking, when young people are irresponsible with money, That's what this is going to talk about. And so Allah calls the young, and when we're saying young, scholars differ. Imam Abu Hanifa said, rahimahullah, you are young until you hit 25. So when you're below 25, all your money, you're still a safi. That's according to him. Other scholars said different ages. Some scholars said, no, it's maturity and above. So you're looking at like 13 to 15 and above. Others said, no, the moment that they have been given inheritance, so when these orphans get whatever amount they get, whatever wealth they own, doesn't matter their age, it belongs to them. So whether they use it irresponsibly or not, that's when you can use this ayah. So there's no age bracket. It's just, see how this goes. So scholars differ on what exactly is a young, irresponsible person in this ayah. Can I ask, in our culture here, what do you guys think roughly that age would be? So what do you think, at least where we are? When do you think young people are irresponsible with wealth, generally speaking? Yeah. And I would say the same as well. So even probably early teenage years, right? So just put that image in your mind when you were looking at this. So then young people that have been left in your inheritance, second check mark, given an allowance that is reasonable but not to squander the wealth of parents. So not all of them will have access to everything, but whatever money they do get, so in context, whatever wealth these orphans do get, then the owner or the protector, his or her job is to ensure that they are reasonable in how they spend this money. So what does that mean? It means that you literally do what is necessary. You buy what is necessary. So we used this example before that, okay, if you need a car, don't go buy like a Lexus or something. You buy a simple car just because they have the wealth. That's not how you use it. That's a general rule of thumb in anything that we do, especially when it comes to our kids. You know, there was a story a while ago. I heard different, you know, stories very similar to this of when some parents had bought their kids their first car or their first cell phone, and you went and they went and they bought the top of the line everything, only to realize that a few months later the kid destroyed the phone or dropped it 100 times, cracked the screen, did something, dented this brand new car. So what happened is that the parent is totally shocked, like, look at how, you know, you're not taking this seriously, you're not grateful. Okay, I'm going to buy you one more Lexus, but that's it. Buys him another car, or you're going to get like a, I hope no one owns a Honda here, but I love Hondas, by the way. I'm going to buy you a Honda, you're not going to get a Lexus no more. So 3 months later, he crashes that as well. Bring them now to Muslim Khan, fix my child. He's totally ungrateful. Point is that this ayah is also calling to something here as well. So if you don't give young people that are irresponsible with wealth, what does that mean that young people should eventually start to learn and do? Learn the value of money. How do young people learn the value of money? They work for it. Right? It's one of the worst sentences you can tell young people these days, right? You need to get a job and earn your own money. Right? And then on top of that, I need to see your paychecks. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, you're going to give me your paychecks and they're going in my account. So when you need money, you come to me. I'm your banker. So if there are young people in here that have that set up, thank your parents for it. In all honesty, all jokes aside. This is where, this is something that you need. And this is the way that you learn the value of wealth. All right? And sometimes we need to have that control. Wealth can be beautiful, but it could certainly be the biggest curse of your life. Right? So parents understand that. So when they control that kind of wealth, then certainly you will be very grateful for them one day. And you will say, Mom, Dad, I understand what you did, man. Thank you. Now, today, because I'm working and I'm making good money, I want to give something back to you. And that's how that attitude manifests itself as the years develop. Continue. The assets that Allah made you maintain or over, so feed them from it. So in other words, it's very wordy, but in other words, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, with everything that has been given to you, Allah Azza wa Jal says, الَّذِي جَعْلَ لَكُمْ قِيَامًا وَرْزُقُوهُمْ فِيهَا وَكْسُوهُمْ. So there are two things that you do with this wealth that belongs to these orphans. Number one is you وَرْزُقُوهُمْ, maintain them, feed them, clothe them, doing all of the, basically fulfill all of their needs. We've all heard the word rizq. We all heard the word rizq, right? And rizq is usually translated as what?
Sustenance,
provisions. Is it specified?
No.
Never. So the first responsibility with wealth is you use it for whatever your basic needs are, in terms of food, medications, and things like that. Why? Because to maintain is different for every family. So the first is very generic. So this maintainer of these orphans has got to now understand the needs of these kids. Specifically, okay, this one's allergic to peanuts. This one's got allergies. Okay, she's got something else. And he's going to have to know, and he's going to have to seriously sit there and organize whose money is going to pay for what. Sounds like a full-time job, doesn't it? It's ridiculously, like, unbelievably complicated. Like, you need organization behind this. You know, again, when I say it like that, just think about what you hear, what you've always known about how orphans are treated. Usually thrown into one big room like this. Okay, you get a corner, 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 and that's your home. And three times a day, some dude will stand outside, put a piece of plastic on the ground, and just dump the rice. Like you're feeding cattle, right? And this is just some of the orphans that I've been able to see when I was in, like, Bangladesh and India and so on. And it was, wallahi, I never thought in my life that there were human beings living like that in this world. Like, I didn't ever imagine that that's how some human beings were being treated, let alone children. So these ayat here are strong. Now, in context, the mushrikun at that time, before this ayah was given, is, remember we said that how they had the habit of stealing wealth, so, or they would substitute their own wealth for something better? So, okay, you know, they came with more dirhams or more money. I've got a few, but they'll never know. So take the few, exchange it, take some more, or take some more valuable items from them. So in addition to that, even to maintain, what they would do is they would take a portion of the orphan's wealth and add it to the overall maintenance of themselves, the orphans, and their entire family and property and land and so on. So it'll look like this. He's got three orphans that he's looking after. They each come with a certain amount of inheritance. He'll take a little bit of each, and he'll also make sure that his roof is done. He'll make sure that he, you know, get some animals to harvest and work in the field somewhere. And then he'll say, yeah, yeah, everything that I do here is for them. So that is also rejected. This ayah clearly is, Allah Azza wa Jal says that the wealth is جَعَلَ اللَّهُ لَكُمْ قِيَامًا, that you need to use this because you are the caretaker, you are the one in charge, so you need to be firm and you need to uphold the responsibility. What is theirs is theirs. How many times have we said that so far since the surah started? This is a big problem. Every time you give money to someone else that it doesn't belong to and you say, here, take care of this, you always got to be walking on eggshells. You can't sleep, hoping that, okay, they'll do the right thing. So that was the first command. And then secondly, feed them from it and clothe them. So now Allah highlights the second most important thing, which was, so maintainer over them, here specifically, is highlighting food. And then the second, waksuhum, clothe them. It was the two things that these children were missing the most. They never had enough food, or they just had one piece of clothing. So Allah said, these are the two things you should focus on the most. And speak to them in a decent, respectful manner. So, have you all seen this word before? Ma'ruf. My students from the other surah, we did ma'ruf. As well as Surah Al-Baqarah, we went through ma'ruf. in context of children. So in this here, when you're dealing with kids, the Quran gives you one order alone when it uses ma'ruf. When it comes to children, how do you use ma'ruf with children? Now, ma'ruf is a universal standard of how you interact with people. But it's different when you're into when those people are your family. There's a level of ma'ruf. When you're dealing with the general public, there's a level of ma'ruf. That's standard. Doesn't matter if they're here or some other country or culture. You're dealing with them the exact same way. When it comes to children, there's only one way across the board that Allah tells us how to use ma'ruf with them. Everybody see ya? How does the verse end? And speak to them in a decent, respectful manner. That's Allah's order, not just for orphans. That's Allah's order of how you talk to young people in general, anywhere in the world. It's amazing. Every youth council and youth program on earth needs to have that as their, you know, stuck on their wall. All those institutes that say, you know, or those masjids and things like that say, you know, we need to focus on the youth. You know, let's just build a gym. Just throw them in there. All right? And then make sure we buy them burgers so they're happy. Let's bring some guy and then he'll just teach them for a few hours a day. So we're done. We never have to go there and talk to anyone. No, actually, it's a principle. And it came only five sentences after in the surah. After five sentences, Allah says, make sure you speak to them. Listen to the ayah. Waqulu, Arabic students, waqulu, one, lahum, two, qawlan, three, and then describe qawlan, ma'rufa. Four things Allah is saying for one action. Waqulu is the order. Qawlan, waqulu lahum is an emphasis. So when you're speaking, don't just speak randomly. So if there's like a few kids in front of you, just be like, okay, everybody just, you know, you guys are good and we love you, okay? Make it personal. Lahum, make it come from your heart really to them. Kids, so it goes from, okay, you guys are going to be great kids, so just have fun. To, hey, you guys are my favorite. You know why? Because one day you're going to be here. That's why I'm here. And you start shaking their hands, and you give them treats, and you really take care of them. That's lahum. So make this respectful tone and manner that you use, make it personal. وَقُولُوا لَهُمْ قَوْلًا. Allah didn't say أَقْوَالًا, not the plural. قَوْلًا, singular. What does that tell you about every word that you utter and say with young people should be? What does that mean? When are we allowed to lose that respectful tone with young people? You're generally speaking, you're not. The rules are changed with parents, by the way. And the reason why I say this, the Quran makes exceptions for parents. You know, when it came to parenting, Allah called kids fitna. That's one of their names in Quran. وَعْلَمُوا أَنَّمَا أَمْوَالُكُمْ وَأَوْلَادُكُمْ فِتْنَةً. Understand that money and wealth, it's fitna. In one context, it's talking to parents. Yeah, because raising kids, that's a whole different story. When you're raising these children, that's a different story. Parents have the right to lose their cool once in a while. And it's actually the kids that have to swallow that. You don't get to talk back and say, oh, mom, why are you getting so angry for? You don't get to do that. You don't get to say, you should never talk to me that way. Those are your parents. So the rules are a bit loose. This is a general rule of thumb and principle across the board. When you're dealing with young people, deal with them in a respectful way. And Allah said, قَوْلًا. قَوْلًا is just one word. So even if it's just one word to Allah, it's something respectful. So you hold on to that. Okay. That's the tone. So ma'ruf, I wrote there, major internal bankruptcy in the ummah. Just across the board in general, how we deal with each other. I said that ma'ruf means a universal standard. So we don't get to call somebody an idiot and say, hey, I don't think that's a bad word. You don't get to do that. Because why? The standard across the board is that you don't call people those names. So you don't get to talk that way to children, and you don't get to talk that way to each other, because that's not the standard that people use across the board. It's never considered to be a good thing. Okay, we continue. Is everybody with me so far? Does anybody have any questions or anything?
Invest the money, in good intentions, like thinking to kind of grow the money. Can you do that, or the caretaker?
There are exceptions to it, right? Especially now, because of the wealth of orphans is regulated, and it's not something that's just open and free, and you get access to it and go do whatever you want. A lot of that I've heard is regulated through a system, so. The general rule of thumb, again, is that if that particular system allows some sense of control and preservation for that wealth, so if you do invest, that you will always be guaranteed a particular amount or return. Like, there has to be a bracket where even if you lose, it's not going to affect your responsibility with that child. That's the most important thing. So it's kind of like yes and no. Just depending on what the investment is and depending where that child is and what system they're affiliated with. But generally speaking, without even thinking that far, the answer will always be no, that we are not allowed to do anything with their wealth except to their own interest, right?
When it comes to money, so if he's going to sit in a bank or whatever it is, by the time they become mature, he's going to have there's no value to it.
So you just reminded me. There is one scenario that I read a long time ago that it was allowed to use this money for anything that is other than providing for those kids once the child has reached to a point where you can have a conversation with them and explain to them that, hey, this is yours, but this is what we want to do with it because this is what could happen for you. So keeping that child in the same conversation, more or less, was a condition that some of the ulama put on it. But to say outright clearly, yes, you can, or no, you can, is really difficult to do that. Right? So it would just kind of come down to, an imam or a judge to decide what is best. Allah knows best. Number six. Yeah. The risk would come because the wealth, it doesn't actually belong to you. That's where the risk is. So this wealth comes under the ownership and title of this kid and their family. That's the only risk. So where you decide to go, even if there is a guaranteed return, that's all good. It's just that where does this child stay in all of this? What is their position in all of this? And this is why I say it's really hard to say generally across the board, and that somebody, a scholar or an imam, and even I would also, encourage even like an expert to really sit there and decide what they feel is best at that point. So they would really not just look at the kid alone, they'd look at a lot of other factors of where he or she came from and what their families and relatives, etc. All of these factors will have to play in to decide. Yeah. I don't know. Allah knows best. It sounds familiar, but I don't want to say that. I would have to look it up. Allah knows best. I don't know. It depends on the provider, but the orphan's wealth itself, Allah knows best. There's an ikhtilaf on it. Some say yes, some say no, and then some even decide on those who are in charge. Let's just take one more verse. This is the longer one, actually. Okay. Shall we take one more? Because when we get to number 6, 7, 8, 9, around the 10th, you're going to see the verse that will really break down inheritance very specifically. That's not something that we're going to do here, because it's not our subject. It's an area where scholars have written volumes of material on. So it's a very lengthy discussion, and it requires a separate class by itself. So we want to at least finish this particular theme, and that's a good place for us to pause. And test the orphans, وَبِتَلُوا الْيَتَامَ, in their abilities until they reach marriageable age. وَبِتَلُوا الْيَتَامَ حَتَّى إِذَا بَلَغُوا النِّكَاحِ. Here's a hint. This is a hint now of how you can slowly start to give some of the wealth back to these orphans. When they get closer and closer to the age or maturity level where they can marry, then you slowly start giving them. So what does Allah say? Test them. Test the orphans. You know what's amazing? It's the word that Allah used to describe this test. Doesn't use ikhtibar. Doesn't use imtihan. It says ibtila'un. Have you heard this word before? وَلَنَبْلُوَنَّكُمْ بِشَيْءٍ مِّنَ الْخَوْفِ. Same verb. That's remarkable to me, because the same kind of test that is used to describe tragedy and hardship that happens to all of mankind is the same attitude Allah is using when it comes to the wealth of orphans. What do we get from this? This is how Allah, again, indirectly, just through language, shows you and I, this is how serious you have to be when you're dealing with somebody else's money. Is that you're going to take a portion. It's not specified how much. It just says, وَبَتَلُوا الْيَتَامَ. So just test them. Take something out of it. Test them with just a little bit of responsibility. But your attitude when you do this, whether it be through money or something else, a responsibility you give them, you have to be prepared that it's going to be a potential disaster, because this is the first time they're exposed to anything like this. See the attitude? So, again, the mushrikun had a problem with this ayah. You know, there's several stories I found as I was reading through this tafsir of mushrikun that would hold some of these orphans accountable if they used this money wrongfully, or they wasted it on something, or there were even some stories of some orphans that lost the coins. They just lost it, like a lot of kids do. And as a result, they were beaten by their owners for this. So Allah is saying, go in with the mindset that you'll lose everything or whatever it is that you test them with. That's really important, because now, whatever happens, still have a good heart. And you'll still just, okay, don't worry about it. I was prepared for that anyway. So Allah says, وَبِتَلُوا الْيَتَامَ, until they reach marriageable age. So this ayah was revealed in the case of Thabit ibn Rifa'i radiallahu anhu. When he passed away, he left behind his son who was still a child. His uncle asked the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam how he should distribute his nephew's wealth, and this ayah was given. So the point is that what was happening was, again, there was a risk that all of the wealth that was left behind from Thabit ibn Rabai radiallahu anhu, no one was really there to control when and who and how this should be used. So this ayah started to give some guidelines, which we haven't had yet. Everything that we've been talking about so far was about responsibility, care, and that sort of thing. Now Allah is going to give us some protocol of what to do. So approach this. Marriageable age, then if you perceive them in sound judgment, release their property to them. Do you see what happened? فَإِنْ آنَسْتُم مِّنْهُمْ رُشْدًا فَادْفَعُوا إِلَيْهِمْ أَمْوَالَهُمْ. If they start showing that they can handle their own wealth, their own money, just give it to them. Now in context, okay, fine, makes sense. Generally speaking, in life, is this a right time to do that? When your child is ready for marriage, is this a good time also to introduce them to the responsibility of wealth and how it's used to maintain themselves and their family, etc.? Murray, you said no. Talk, why? So keep in mind, it's marriageable age. So it's just around. So it's not necessarily they're going to get married or the intention is there. But if that ever comes up, they're ready for it. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. So the point is, at the end of the day, again, this is one of those areas that's lost quite a bit in the Muslim world. So many people get involved and marry, and this is a conversation that almost never happens, or it just happens in a really weird way, where, okay, we're just going to talk about saving, or we're just going to talk about this is what we're going to do with it, et cetera, et cetera. But the whole responsibility factor of it is really tough. And yeah, I totally agree that marriage is one of the ways that you will have to learn that, and it's sometimes really difficult. So the point is, I wrote at the bottom here, nikah in this ayah refers to maturity. So although the same word is used, and we know what it is, in this ayah, it's not actually referring to marriage itself. It's referring to the maturity stage when you're prepared for marriage. So even though you can marry, doesn't necessarily mean you are going to marry, but it's the maturity level. Again, huge, huge area of discussion, big dilemma in our ummah. Then if you perceive them to have sound judgment, no questions asked, you release it to them. Okay, so in context, that makes sense. Do not consume it excessively. So Allah continues and says, وَلَا تَأْكُلُوهَا إِسْرَافًا وَبِدَارًا أَنْ يَكْبَرُوا. So two things. إِسْرَافًا, excessively, بِدَارًا, and quickly, anticipating that they will grow up. Can someone give me an example of that? You give wealth to a mature young student. How the one excessively there, okay, fine, that makes sense. Quickly and anticipating that they will grow up. What is this all about?
Stopping to the guardians. Stopping to the guardians. That they should not abuse off his wealth, that, you know, they would have to hand it over, so they're using it and they were allowed to use it. If they needed to, so they should not be using it excessively and quickly, hoping that, okay, this time is going to come, we have to give it to them, so let's do what we can in the meantime.
Okay, good, good. Anything else? You want to add something? Or?
Yeah.
Okay, so gradually, okay, responsibly. Okay. And whoever, when acting as a guardian, is self-sufficient, this is unreal, self-sufficient should refrain from taking a fee. So in other words, if the guardian now is able to sustain himself and the orphans, then what happens? It's still theirs. Don't touch it. So in other words, if they've been blessed with an enormous amount of wealth, this wealth still belongs to them, but you don't need to access it. Although they're mature enough to handle their own cash, you don't need to. So the guardian will then give money and wealth from their own, you know, pocket, if you say, and that money now belongs to them. You give and maintain them. So it's now almost like a real, these are your children and you're caring for them now. See the attitude? And whoever, when I say the assessor, should refrain from taking a fee, and whoever is poor, let him take according to what is acceptable. Again, so we've already talked about, in other words, take the bare minimum. Then when you release their property to them, bring witness upon them, and sufficient is Allah as the accountant. So in other words, if you do this, you end up giving the wealth to them, then ensure that you have witness and things are done correctly. Again, when it comes to money, all throughout the Quran, whether it's paying for something, whether it's taking a loan or paying off a debt, you name it. Everything to do with money in the Quran is never done alone. There's always witnesses involved. Okay? Those of you who did Surah Al-Baqarah with me, you would remember the longest ayah of the entire Quran is devoted to what subject? Yeah, money. The longest sentence of the Quran Allah devoted to? Not salah and zakat and hajj. Money. It's a big deal in Quran. Last one. Let's take this ayah. Then Allah continues. لِلْرِجَالِ نَصِيبٌ مِمَّا تَرَكَ الْوَالِدَانِ وَالْأَقْرَبُونَ. For men especially, there will be a portion for what both parents left behind. This ayah is starting to introduce now how the inheritance is distributed. And this particular ayah has a context to it as well. Take a look at the first check mark. Now, by the way, before we even do that, do you see why part of the ayah at the end I wrote in green? I believe this is not in your books. That last sentence there. So if you check verse number 7, if you need to write it down, you may need to do that. I have no idea why it's not in there. So just take a few seconds to do that. This ayah was revealed when a man passed away and left his wife and 3 daughters. So 2 boys, 2 nephews from the father's side, came and took the inheritance. Look what happened. This was the practice. So this wife and her 3 daughters left behind. The kids, their cousins, 2 boys, came and literally just took all the property out of their home. So the 2 nephews came and took the inheritance left behind and did not share any of it with the mother and her daughters. So they basically permitted themselves to walk into somebody's house, their own family, and just take everything and just be like, yeah, you guys don't deserve any of this. Okay. Then this mother, she went to the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam. Okay, so before we get that, it was said that the women and the kids back then would receive inheritance only if they demonstrate the following. So here's how, if you were a woman or a child, here's how you got some inheritance, not a lot. Maybe you might just get just like a handful of something back then. These are the 3 conditions you needed to have. You had to possess the ability to engage in battle whilst riding on a horse or a camel. So you're not standing on your own 2 feet, but you're moving at the same time. So in other words, if you can control the animal and control your engagement with the enemy, then that's one thing. So you had to demonstrate that. The second was you had to possess a skill in using a spear. Engaged in an individual battle. So here you are now with the opposition. So you have to now demonstrate how you combat by yourself with no help. And then the third was with a sword and retrieve the war booty. So the third one is you do the same combat, only that time you're using a sword. And then if you take out the enemy, you should be able to go and take all of their weapons and ammunition and everything. You should be able to confiscate all of that. If you were a woman or a child, you had to go through that, I guess, exam. And if you passed and everybody who watched you said, okay, you know what? You're a woman, but you're kind of not. So you're good. You're a kid, but no, you're not just any kid. So you're good. It's really awful. It's a disgusting practice. Right? So that was the process they put them through then. The woman came to the Prophet ﷺ, this mother of the 3 daughters. And she told the situation about these 2 kids that came and what they did. The Prophet ﷺ says, leave until I see what has revealed to me given to the women. That's what he told these 2 boys. So the Prophet ﷺ, when she came to him, he called these 2 boys in front of him. And he said to him, leave, meaning leave the wealth that you took from them until I see what Allah has revealed to me given to these women. In other words, drop everything you took from that house and you can never touch it until this whole ayah is done. So in other words, everybody gets their portion. If there's something left, then part of the verse is up to the mom to decide if she wants to give it away or not. So if there is something there, you don't get to take it either. she gets to decide. That's how the Prophet ﷺ got control and ensured that this practice eventually stopped. By the way, there are hundreds of stories like this. Really awful stories. Really disgusting practices that not just the women had to endure, but just the culture itself pre-Islam. And I want to leave you with one statement of Umar ibn al-Khattab radiallahu anhu. And when you read what's in yellow there, when you read stories like that, appreciate what he said, Umar ibn al-Khattab radiallahu anhu. He said, you can only appreciate Islam if you studied and learned what pre-Islam was and what all those generations had to endure and the practices that they went through. Then you will really and truly appreciate the blessing of this deen. And that's just one very random example. There are thousands of examples like that. And this is just to do with wealth. We're not even talking about marriage. We're not even talking about slaves. We're not talking about nothing else. So really sets the tone of how incredibly powerful this surah is. It literally came and changed the entire Muslim world until Yawm al-Qiyamah. I love how it's called Surah An-Nisa. I couldn't think of a better surah name than Surah An-Nisa. And you know why? Because it's no secret, alhamdulillah, at least these days, that how important a woman is to a family, to a community, the impact that she makes in a classroom even. You know, when generally speaking, and this is something that happened throughout the Muslim world, as the Quran was being revealed, more and more women started creating and leaving legacies that was unheard of. You know, recently, I think it was about 5 years ago or something like that, there was the famous scholar, Moroccan scholar, a woman by the name of Bahia bint Hashim, rahmatullahi alayha. She was one of the top Quran scholars in the world. You know, no one knew she existed because she lived in a remote area in Morocco. And this journalist from the UK, he was visiting Morocco, and he had heard about, there was this famous scholar. She had license to teach all the recitations of the Quran, and she had one of the strongest isnads, or lineages to the Quran, in the Quran, in the world. So he wanted to find who she was, and everybody was like, oh yeah, Bahia, she's over there, there, there. Took a ride for about 3 hours in the middle of the desert, and found her living in this mud wall. And when she came out, she was blind. So she's a blind person, and she actually wrote by hand the entire Quran in Braille, and it was the first Quran for all of Egypt. So it was sent out from Morocco, Egypt got a copy of it, it was the first Braille Quran, and now it was from her. Have you heard these names before? Mashari Rashid, Sa'ad al-Ghamidi, some of the Imams of the Haram, Hudhayfi, Sudais. They all read Quran to her. And they were only given permission to go lead prayer through her. She lived till I think she was 110. That's when she passed away. You know, just think about where we were and where we are. We still have a long way to go. But my point is this, and especially because, you know, mashallah, a lot of you sisters are here. You know, when you put your mind to something, I don't think there is a soul on earth that can really see what impact you can have on this ummah. And it's really, we have the book, we have the knowledge here in front of us. It's really up to you to take this torch and see how bright you can make it for yourself and how it enlightens the rest of this ummah. You have the ability to do that, and you should by no means take advantage of doing that and contribute however it is that you can. Some of the greatest muhaddithat, scholars of hadith on earth, were women. They preserved most of our deen. Have you ever heard of a woman that fabricated a hadith against Prophet ﷺ? Because it doesn't exist. Never did a woman tell a lie about him and narrated something about him. So much so that Bukhari, rahimahullah, narrated thousands of hadith that he heard just from women. So it's really, really, I don't want you to just look at this as another surah that we journey through. I want you to make this very personal. And for us brothers as well, there's a lot here that we're gonna be listening to that is just important to us as anyone else. So I want you to really make this a personal journey for yourself, that perhaps inshallah, how Surah An-Nisa has empowered women back then, it continues to do so through all of you today.